So tonight, it's a bit of an odd topic. It's kind of introduction to the Buddhist worldview. Last week I talked about these six sentences. They're called in Tibetan lojams, or kind of Buddhist slogans. And there's a whole practice associated with these, and a whole series of them. And so tonight I thought I'd just talk about the first four preliminary lojans, which are really about just laying out, you might say, the basics of Buddhism. And so this translation is from Pema Chodron, who did this. And so I'll pass this sheet out later, but I'll just read the first two. So the preliminaries are also known as the four reminders. In your daily life, try to, one, maintain an awareness of the preciousness of human life, and two, be aware of the reality that life ends, death comes for everyone. So I'll just start with those two. There's a very traditional Buddhist view that all of us who are human have kind of won this kind of lottery among animals, that all there are all these animal souls that are trying to get to human birth, and then the people who are human have kind of, you know, scored big in the reincarnation cycle. So we have this opportunity as humans. And Buddha teaches, they talk about the six realms. Of the six realms, the human realm is considered the most auspicious for achieving enlightenment. Now, you don't have to accept any of that Buddhist mythology, but just in practical terms, I think I would say each one of us has a precious gift. Each one of us has a valuable contribution to make to the world. And so there's something just precious about that. Something that we can contribute, each one of us can contribute, that no one else can contribute. And making this contribution, I mean, there are some people who just spontaneously make that contribution when they're in their teens or 20s or whatever. But for most of us, making that contribution requires some spiritual work. And spiritual work is hard, and it's a long process. And so I see part of these preliminary lojans as just setting a tone of, you might say, of urgency around our spiritual development. That, you know, it's very easy, you know, we all have human concerns, jobs, and, you know, paying the rent and health issues and things like that. It's very easy to let those ordinary everyday activities become the whole of our life. And so part of Buddhism is presenting this kind of urgency about prioritizing spiritual work, however that looks for you. You know, for some people it's meditation, for some people it's yoga, for, you know, it, journaling. There's all kinds of ways that spiritual work can happen. But in some way, making a priority of it, because our time is precious. And, you know, especially for those of us who are aging, we appreciate that each decade brings further challenges with it, you know. And so better to be working on it in the time we have now rather than 2 decades from now, that kind of thing. And part of the idea implicit in that is just the basic Buddhist truth of impermanence. And this is something that the Buddha talked about quite a bit. Everything is impermanent. All physical objects, human dynamics, human connections, governments, certainly. All sorts of situations are impermanent. Many beliefs are impermanent. You know, you may well have had the experience earlier in life of having these passionate beliefs, and you're sure the world was one way, and a course, that belief is long gone at this point. And so it's this, how can I say? It's this very difficult, very challenging situation that, and Buddhism doesn't really pull any punches about how challenging the human situation is. Anything that we cling to, we could lose. Anyone we cling to, we could lose. And again, Buddhism would really urge us to look at, you know, what can we rely on? Buddhism talks about the three refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, as these things that we can constantly take refuge in, take comfort in. The third and the fourth. Number three, recall that whatever you do, whether virtuous or not, has a result. What goes around comes around. Four, contemplate that as long as you are too focused on self-importance and too caught up in thinking about how you are good or bad, you will suffer. Obsessing about getting what you want and avoiding what you don't want does not result in happiness. And so that third one is of course, the law of karma. And karma is a very interesting idea. The word karma literally just means action. And in Hinduism, that's all it means, action. Karma yoga is the yoga of an active life. You know, from a Hindu point of view, Gandhi was an exemplar of karma yoga, someone who lived out their spiritual ideals in action. But the Buddha changed the meaning of this word. He changed it to mean not only the action you do, but all the consequences you have. And of course, the Buddha felt that the actions we do, they have the obvious consequences, but then there's this whole trail of consequences beyond that. And the more impactful the deed, the more potent the consequences down the road. And Buddhism has these advanced, you know, metaphysical systems to explain how these consequences even go from one life to the next, and this sort of thing. Again, we don't have to accept all this, that philosophical stuff, but just in practical terms, very practical, just what we know about ordinary, the body, the mind, ordinary biochemistry. Suppose I'm out somewhere and I take a real disliking to someone, and I yell at them and I tell them off, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I might be telling myself, that's the only person I have a problem with. That person. I want them out of my life. And I want to be friendly to everyone else. Well, of course, if I'm cruel to that one person, and especially if I'm still, like, seething with anger the next few days, part of my body is in fight or flight. And fight or flight has all kinds of physiological symptoms. It, you know, we don't know for sure, but probably it's sending out pheromones of various kinds. And so all the other people I'm meeting might be wonderful, sensitive, open-hearted people, but they're going to get a whiff of, there's something off about this person, or something dangerous or unsettled, or I don't know what, and people are not going to be connecting with me quite as readily because I'm carrying this energy. And it might be entirely out of my own awareness even. But the fact that I had that one interaction has, you might say, karmic impact on how I relate with others. And similarly, when we take up practices like a metta practice or a gratitude practice, a loving kindness practice, it just predisposes us to be more accepting, more open-hearted. And when we're in a more relaxed place, then our mind is wide open. Then we can appreciate details that otherwise we might have missed. Now, The funny thing is, of course, you know, it would be, as you probably know, it would be a little bit out of character for me to just, you know, scream bloody murder at somebody. And I imagine it would be out of character for most of the people here. I really think the people who pursue spiritual paths, the big challenge is not the person, the other person that we're cruel to, but the ways that we're cruel to ourselves. The voices that we carry that are cruel. And from the point of view of Buddhism, Buddhism teaches compassion toward all beings. From the point of view of Buddhism and karmic consequences, it doesn't really matter whether the person I'm cruel to is somebody else or myself. That's still cruelty, you know? You know, the Protestant ethic has this weird, like, you know, you have to be generous to everyone else and then mean to yourself. Like, there's all kinds of bizarre messages we've gotten from the Puritans and from, you know, others. And so I think I would say that, how to say it, something I've talked about before, the teaching of universal compassion, which is a core Buddhist teaching, is a very profound teaching. And in fact, I see it very much in parallel with the Christian teaching of love thy enemies. You know, love thy enemies is a lovely sentiment until we actually consider the people that are actually might be our enemies, you know. Politicians we don't like or so forth. So universal compassion is a teaching not only about compassion to every being outside, but also to every voice inside. And of course, it's very easy to be compassionate to the places in us that are happy, that are relaxed, that are joyful, that are playful. And it's much harder to be compassionate to the places that are critical, that hold pain, that hold shame. And one way to think about it is, imagine a parent, and some of you have been parents, imagine a parent with two children, say like a six-year-old kid who was saying, you know, mommy, daddy, I love you so much, and then a three-year-old who's in mid-temper tantrum who's saying, you know, mommy, daddy, I hate you. You know, the wise parent, you're going to love both those children. You know, a more immature parent, like, you know, might like the feedback from the first one and, you know, might almost want to punish the other kid. And of course, punishing that kid would be traumatizing actually to both kids. But the wise parent loves both children, and the wise parent is mature enough to realize the verbal content of whatever a three-year-old is saying, like, that can be disregarded. You know, a three-year-old is in pain, and they're saying whatever they say, and what they're really saying is, I'm in pain, I need comforting. And so it's easy to have that perspective with real children, but we forget that we carry these immature places inside ourselves. And so a critical voice is often like the child in temper tantrum. You know, and our minds, there's a way that our minds can be such suckers. They believe the verbal content of everything. Like they get verbal content from anywhere and they, oh, that, well, that must be true. They said it's true, you know. These, especially the critical voices and the difficult voices that recur, they recur because there's something there that needs to be felt. And in a way, what's happening is the criticism comes and it gives us a feeling, and that's the only way that this place has to get our attention, as it were. And there's something there that simply needs to be felt. And the woman who used to lead this Sangha, Rain, she always liked to say, all emotions want is to be felt. That's all they want. And so this fourth truth about being fascinated with ourselves, I think we all get that if someone walks around, you know, I'm the greatest, I'm better than anyone. Like, obviously that's a very unhealthy fascination with oneself. And probably if I'm walking around like that all the time, I'm not going to be able to appreciate what's so great about all the other people because I'm too wrapped up in what's great about myself. But it's also a kind of self-fascination to walk around saying, I'm the worst, you know, because that also takes me out of the present moment. It prevents me from connecting with my heart. It prevents me from connecting with others. It prevents me from being fully present and fully open. And so both kinds of self-fascination, whether it's, you know, extreme self-praise or extreme self-criticism, both of them are take us out of the present moment. And then this final idea, obsessing about getting what you want and avoiding what you don't want does not result in happiness. At this point in my life, it's almost comic when I look at this, because, and if you think about it, probably all of you have had this experience, countless times I've looked forward to something and, wow, this is going to be the greatest thing ever. This is going to be the best. This is going to be a life-changing thing. And then it comes and it's like, that's all there is? And then similarly, you know, this is going to be the worst thing. Oh my God, this is going to be destroy my, oh my, this is going to be the worst thing imaginable. And then it comes and it's like, oh, that's all it was, you know? And usually the things that are really wonderful or really horrible sideswipe us anyway. Like we never even saw them coming, you know? And so like any of this mental energy that we're spending about thinking that, you know, that's going to be the best, that's going to be the worst, like this mental energy is completely wasted because we have no idea what it's going to be like until it's present. So I'll read some of the quotes here. In fact, at this point, I'll pass out the quote sheet. I always have a quote sheet at these. I used to be a teacher, so I always have handouts. So the four reminders, again, in Pema Chodron's translation at the top. So I love this kind of summary quote from the Buddha. Life is so very difficult. How can we be anything but kind? You know, and just realizing it's difficult for me, it's difficult for everyone out there. And just to hold that as a kind of general kindness toward all. The pre-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus tells us simply, there's nothing permanent except change. He lived around the same time as the Buddha. Da Vinci says, well, I thought I was learning how to live. I have been learning how to die. I love this one from John Ruskin. A man wrapped up in himself makes a very small parcel. Robert Louis Stevenson, everybody sooner or later sits down to a banquet of consequences. Wow. And similarly, Reverend Inge, there are no rewards or punishments, only consequences. The theologian Reinhold Niebuhr says, all human sin seems so much worse in its consequences than in its intentions. This is a very touching one from Lillian Hellman. People change and forget to tell each other. A couple from Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor. If there is meaning in life at all, there must be meaning in suffering. Suffering is an ineradicable part of life, even as fate and death. Without suffering and death, human life cannot be complete. And then also from him, when we are no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. And again, this is a man who lived through the Holocaust saying that. Thich Nhat Hanh says, the most precious gift we can offer others is our presence. When mindfulness embraces those we love, they will bloom like flowers. This one I really found touching from Anne Frank. I see the world being slowly transformed into wilderness, and I hear the approaching thunder that one day will destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions, and yet when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better, that this cruelty too shall end, that peace and tranquility will return once more. Astonishing presence this young woman had. Yoko Ono simply says you change the world by being yourself. Very simple. The astronomer Carl Sagan, our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light, meaning the Earth we're on. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. Pema Chodron says, to be fully alive, fully human, and completely awake is to be continually thrown out of the nest. To live fully is to be in no man's land, to experience each moment as completely new and fresh. To live is to be willing to die over and over again. Norman Davies says, serenity is the balance between good and bad, life and death, horrors and pleasures. Life is, as it were, defined by death. If there wasn't a death of things, there wouldn't be any life to celebrate. I've never heard of this author, Eric Pevernagy. The day we decide to drop the flimsy makeshift scenarios in our cluttered mind and eschew alleluias of self-importance, life can become genuine, lucid, and graceful, like a flow of wellness in the glow of a new morning. Eckhart Tolle says, wherever you are, be there totally. If you find the here and now intolerable and it makes you unhappy, you have three options. Remove yourself from the situation, change it, or accept it totally. If you want to take responsibility for your life, you must choose one of those three options and choose now, then accept the consequences. The Zen teacher Sharon Salzberg says, we long for permanence, but everything in the known universe, thoughts, peoples, galaxies, is transient. That's a fact, but one we fight. A touching one from Steve Jobs. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. And then this woman, I wasn't able to find much at all about her, Rosanna Condoleo. The role of any person in the world is to be themselves without damaging the rest. We are important as long as the rest is.